forest without green leaves. Twisted and tangled branches bore no fruit, only the thorns of poison bloomed there. Around me I could hear low wails of grief, but could see no one. It was as if many people were hiding from us behind the trees and bushes. I reached out and snapped a twig from a thorn bush.
Why do you break me?
Its blood grew dark around the wound.
Have you no pity? Men we once were, now bushes and weeds. But even if we were the souls of serpents, your hand should have shown more mercy.
Like a green log burning at one end and spluttering sap at the other, the broken branch poured out a pus of words and blood. I let it fall from my hand and stood there, stiff with fear.
When a tormented soul rips itself from the body, Minos sends it down to the seventh hole and it drops into this wood. There we germinate and spring into a sapling and then into a tree. The harpies, feasting on our leaves, create our pain, and for this pain, an outlet. We return to claim our bodies, but never to wear them again. For it is not for a man to have again what once he cast off. We drag them here, and all along this mournful forest. Leaves create our pain, and for this pain, an outlet. We return to claim our bodies, but never to wear them again. For it is not for a man to have again what once he cast off. We drag them here, and all along this mournful forest.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. You're listening to another episode of Good Night Norman, hosted by me, if I'm really a host, Norman Douglas. It's midnight or a couple minutes after on the 20th of June, the last day of spring. What a lovely spring it's been. Tonight I'm going to read a story by Rosario Ferre, born in Puerto Rico in 1942. This story is entitled When Women Love Men. It begins with an epigram. La puta que yo conozco, no, me libre yo. Porque la puta viene de Ponce, viene del barrio de San Antón. That's a lyric from the song Plena de San Antón, which basically means, in my translation, the whore that I know isn't from China or Japan, because that whore comes from Ponce, comes from the barrio of San Antón. The epigram continues with a citation from St. Paul's Epistle to the Corinthians, also known as the Epistle of Love. It reads, "For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as also I am known." When Women Love Men by Rosario Perez. It happened when you died, Ambrosio, and you left each of us half your inheritance. It was then that all this confusion began, this scandal spinning all over like an iron hoop, smashing your good name against the walls of the town. This slapped and stunned confusion that you swung around for the sake of power, pushing us both downhill at the same time. Anyone would say that you did what you did on purpose, just for the pleasure of seeing us light a candle in each corner of the room to see which one of us had won. At least that's what we thought then, before we sensed your true intentions. Now we know that you really wanted, what you really wanted was to meld us, to make us fade into each other like an old picture lovingly placed under its negative, so that our own true face would finally come to surface. When all is said and done, this story is not so strange, Ambrosio. It seems almost inevitable that it should have happened the way it did. We, your lover and your wife, have always known that every lady hides a prostitute under her skin. This is obvious from the way a lady slowly crosses her legs, rubbing the insides of her thighs against each other. It's obvious from the way she soon gets bored with men. She never knows what we go through, plagued by them for the rest of our lives. It's evident in the prim way she looks at the world from under the tips of her eyelashes, as she hides the green-blue lights that swarm beneath her skirt. A prostitute, on the other hand, will go to similar extremes to hide the lady under her skin. Prostitutes all drown in the nostalgia of that dovecote-like cottage they'll never own, of a house with a balcony of silver amphorae, with fruited garlands hanging over the doors. They all suffer from hallucinations, such as listening for the sounds of silver and china before dinner time, as though invisible servants were about to set the family table. The truth is, Ambrosio, that we, Isabel Luberza and Isabel La Negra, have been leaning more and more on each other. We had purified each other of all that defiled us, and we had grown so close that we no longer knew where the lady ended and the prostitute began. You were to blame, Ambrosio, for the fact that no one could tell us apart after a while. Was it Isabel Luberza who began the campaign to restore the plaster lines of the town square? Or was it Isabel La Negra who misspent the funds in making herself beautiful for the rich boys of the town? The sons of your friends that used to visit my shack every night, their shoulders drooping and dragging themselves like pigeons gripped by consumption, staring hungrily at my body as though at a promised banquet. Was it Isabel Luberza, the Red Cross lady, or was it Elizabeth the Black, the young Lord's president, who used to shout from her platform that she was living proof of the fact that there was no difference between Puerto Ricans and Neo-Ricans, because they had all come together in her cunt? Was it Isabel Luberza who used to collect funds for Boys Town, for the mute and deaf, for Model City, dressed by Fernando Pena with long white lambskin gloves and a silver mink stole? Or was it Isabel the slave driver, the exploiter of innocent little Dominican girls put ashore by smugglers on the beaches of Guyana? Was it Isabel Luberza the popular party lady, Ruth Fernandez's long-lost twin in political campaigns? Or was it Isabel La Negra, the soul of Puerto Rico turned into song, the temptress of Chichamba, the Jezebel of San Antone, the sharpest shooting streetwalker of Barrio de la Cantera, the call girl of Cuatro Calles, the slut of Singapore, the vamp of Machuelo Abajo, the harlot of Coto Loreda? Was it Isabel Luberza, the lady who used to breed pigeons in La Sultana, cracker tins under her zinc-gabled roof? Or was it Isabel La Negra, of whom it could never be said that she was neither fish nor fowl? Was it Isabel Luberza, the baker of charity cupcakes, the knitter of little cloud-colored perle booties and blankets for the unwanted babies abandoned by their mothers on the front steps of the Church of the Sacred Heart? Or was it Isabel the Rumba, Macumba, Candomblé, Bambula, Isabel de Timbandumba, de la Kimbamba, swaying her okra hips, the sun swilled on tea and streets, her grapefruit tits sliced open on her chest. Was it Isabel la Trastamara, the holy queen of Spain, patron of the most aristocratic street in Ponce, or was it Elizabeth the Black, the only lady ever to have bestowed upon her the order of the sainted prepuce of Christ? Was it Saint Elizabeth, mother of Saint Louis, King of France, who's our town's patron saint, lulled to sleep for centuries under the mountainous blue tits of Doña Juana? Was it Isabel Luberce, the Catholic lady, the painter of the most exquisite scapularies of the Sacred Heart, still dripping the only three divine ruby drops capable of conjuring Satan? Was it Isabel Luberce, the champion of the Oblates, carrying a tray with her own pink tits served in syrup before her? Was it Isabel Luberce, the Virgin of the Thumb, piously thrusting her pinky through a little hole embroidered in her gown? Or was it Isabel La Negra, Steppenfetchit's only girlfriend, the only one who ever dared to kiss his deformed feet and cleanse them with her tears, the only one to join the children as they danced around him to the rhythm of his cry? Hershey barks, kisses milky ways through the burning streets of Ponce. Was it Isabel, the black pearl of the south, the Chivas Regal, the queen of Zaba, the Tongolele, the Salome, spinning her gyroscopic belly before the amazed eyes of men, shaking for them her multitudinous cunt and her monumental buttocks, spreading from time immemorial this confusion between her and her, or between her and me, or between me? Because as time went by, it became more and more difficult for us to tell this story. It grew almost impossible to distinguish between the two. So many years of anger stuck like a lump in my throat, Ambrosio. So many years of polishing my fingernails with cherries, Jubilee, because it was the reddest color in fashion at the time. Always with Cherry's Jubilee while I thought of her, Ambrosio, of Isabella Negra, because to begin with it was unusual that I, Isabel Luberce, having such refined taste, should like the shrill and gaudy colors that negros usually prefer. Years of varnishing the contours of the half-moons at the base of my fingernails, of carefully brushing around the edge of the cuticle that always stung a bit as the nail polish fell on it, because when I saw the defenseless soft skin of the cuticle caught between the tips of my cuticle trimmers, it always reminded me of her, and I'd usually cut too deep. I think of all these things as I sit on the balcony of this house that now belongs to both of us, Ambrosio, to Isabel Luberce and to Isabella Negra, this house that will now become a part of our legend, of the legend of the lady and the prostitute. I can already see it turned into a brothel, which is what Isabella Negra plans to do. Its balcony of long silver amphorae will be painted shocking pink. Its balusters are lined along the street like happy phalluses, its snow-white garlanded facades, which now give the impression of cakes coated with heavy icing, spread stiff and sparkling like the skirt of a debutante, will then be washed in warm colors, and chartreuse green fused into chrysanthemum orange, and Pernod blue thawed into dahlia yellow, and those gaudy shades that persuade men to relax, to let their arms slide down their sides as though they didn't have a care in the world, as though they were about to sail out on the deck of a transatlantic luxury liner. The walls of the house, which are now elegantly gessoed, will be painted a bottle green, so that when you and I stand in the main hall, Ambrosio, everything will be revealed to us. We will then see ourselves unfold into 20 identical images reflected in the walls of those rooms that we will rent out to our clients, so that they may have their indifferent orgasms in them, so that we may see them repeat to the end of time the ritual of love. And so here I am, Ambrosio, sitting on the balcony in front of your house, waiting for them to come whisk her away. Waiting to see Isabel Luberce's wake wind its way to a grave that was destined to be my grave, the sacred body of Isabel body which had never before been exposed, not even a sliver of her white buttocks, not even a shaving of her white breasts. Isabel Berce renounces Ambrosio as of today, that virginity of a reputable wife which you had conferred upon her. It makes no difference that she had never before stepped into a brothel, that she had never before been slandered in public, so I have been, as I have been so many times, that she had never bared any part of her body, food for the ravenous eyes of men, except her arms, her neck, or her legs from the shin down. Her body now naked and tinctured black, her sex covered only by a small triangle of amethysts, including the one the bishop once wore on his finger, her nipples trapped in nests of diamonds, fat and round like chickpeas, her feet stuffed into slippers of sparkling red rime with twin hearts sewn on the tips, her heels still dripping a few drops of blood, dressed in short like a queen, as I myself would have liked to be dressed if it had been my funeral. When they bring her out swaying under a mountain of rotting flowers, I'll be waiting right here, Ambrosio. I'll walk up to her then, and I'll scent my own body with fleur de rocaille perfume. I'll whiten my breast with a gendarme powder. I'll do my hair just like hers, spiraled in a cloud of smoke around my head. I'll drape myself in my lamé gown and spill my silver tunic over my shoulder so that it sparkles vengefully in the midday sun. Then I'll bind my throat and wrists with diamond strings. I'll dress exactly as I used to when I was still Isabel Luberza, and you were still alive, Ambrosio, the town spilling itself into the house to attend our parties, and I clinging to your arm like a jasmine vine to the wall, yielding my perfumed hand to be kissed by the guests, my delicate, clinging hand which had already begun to be hers, Ambrosio, Isabella Negras, because even then I could feel the tide of blood rising, soaking my insides with cherries, jubilee. It wasn't until Isabella Negra pounded vigorously on Isabel Luberce's door that the prostitute reconsidered whether she was doing a sensible thing in coming to visit her. She had come to talk to her about the business of the house they had inherited jointly. Ambrosio, the man they had both lived with when they were young, had died many years ago, and Isabella Negra, out of consideration for her namesake, had not pressed her claim to the portion of the house that legally belonged to her. Isabel Luberce was living in the house, and it would have been inelegant to try to evict her. In any case, Isabella Negra had wisely invested the money she had had from this mortgage on her part of the house, so that her mind was at rest as to not having made a poor business deal. She heard that Isabel Luberce was a bit mad. Since Ambrosio's death, she had locked herself up in the house and never went out. She had come to her rival's house thinking that so many years had gone by that all resentment should by now be forgotten. The widow was surely in need of rent money that would assure her a peaceful old age, and this would perhaps spur her to agree to a business deal. Isabella Negra was very interested in becoming Isabel Luberce's partner. Her brothel had been so successful in recent years that she needed to enlarge it, and it would moreover be convenient to take it out of the slum, because in San Antonio it lacked prestige, and even given the impression of being an unhealthy establishment. But her yearning to live in the house, her dream of sitting out on the balcony behind the silver balustrade beneath the baskets of fruit and garlands of flowers, answered to reasons deeper than economic expediency. She knows she suffered from a nostalgia that had become incandescent over the years, burning in her heart like a childhood vision. And this vision, which flashed back to her whenever she walked past Isabel Luberce's house, she'd see herself again as a young girl, barefoot and dressed in rags, looking up at a tall, handsome man, dressed in white linen and Panama hat, who stood leaning out on the balcony next to a beautiful blonde woman, elegantly dressed in a silver lamé gown. That vision was the only gray cloud, the only elusive thorn that disturbed Isabel La Negra's contentment in her approaching old age. It was true, she was now a self-made woman and had achieved an enviable status in the town. Most society women were jealous of her because, with the recent crash of the sugar market, the old families were now ruined and had only the empty pride of their names left to them. They haven't even enough money to take a little trip to Europe once a year like I do. They can't even afford the copies of my designer clothes, she'd tell herself with a smile. Her importance in the economic development of the town was universally acknowledged. She had lately been the recipient of numerous prestigious appointments, such as honorary member of the Lions Club, the Chamber of Commerce, the Bankers Trust. But she felt there was still something missing. She didn't want to die without having at least tried to make her secret dream come true, to imagine herself young once again, dressed in a sumptuous lamé dress, standing on that balcony next to a man with whom she had once been in love. When Isabel Luberso opened the door, Isabel La Negra went weak at the knees. She was still so beautiful. I had to lower my eyes. I almost didn't dare to look at her. I wanted to kiss her eyelids, tender as new coconut flesh, and of a beveled almond shape. She had braided her hair at the nape of her neck, as Ambrosia told me she used to wear it. The odor of fleur de rocaille, her overly sweet perfume, brought me back to reality. I knew I had to convince her that I was being sincere in seeking her friendship, that I would honor my contract with her as a business partner. For a moment, she stared at me so intently that I wondered whether she truly was mad, whether she truly thought of herself as a saint, as they said in town. I'd heard people say she lived obsessed with the idea of redeeming me, that she'd subject her body to all sorts of absurd punishments for my sake. But it didn't really matter. If the rumor was true, I was sure it would work in my favor. After staring at me for a moment, she opened the door, and I went in. When I walked into the living room, I couldn't help but think of you, Ambrosio, of how you'd had me locked up for years in that shack with a zinc roof. There I'd been sentenced to spend my days milking the boys you yourself had introduced to me. Please do my son's friends a favor, Isabel, you'd say. Damn it, Isabel, don't be hard-hearted. You're the only one who knows how to do it. You're the one who does it best. You tell them, sure you can, son, why not? Just let yourself go, that's all, as though you were skiing down a mountain of soap suds without stopping, so their fathers could sleep peacefully because their offspring had not turned out to be gay sissies with porcelain-splintered butts, because they were manly machos, thanks to the coupling of Saint Dagger and Saint Pussy. But your friends could only prove this by sending their sons to me, Ambrosio, and they knew I'd only take care of them if it was you who brought them. And so it was that, just to please you, Ambrosio, I began to kneel in front of the boys like a priestess officiating at a sacred ritual. My hair would blind me as I'd lower my head to sheathe their penises like tender lilies in my throat. Until one day I got to thinking that I wasn't really spending myself with these teenage Romeos because you had asked me to, Ambrosio, but that deep down I was doing it for my sake, to pick up an ancient, almost forgotten taste that leaked out in bittersweet streams down my throat, the taste of power. Because in teaching those boys how to make love, Ambrosio, I also showed them what a real woman is. A real woman is not a sack of flour that lets a man throw her on a bed, just as a real man is not a raping macho, but one that has the courage to let himself be raped. So I devoted myself to teaching the boys how to share a pleasure without having to be ashamed of it. I taught them how to be generous with themselves. Once they left my bed, they could rest easy as to their future performances. They could parade confidently before their girlfriends, like strutting young roosters. After all, someone had to show young men how to take the initiative. Someone had to show them in the first place. And that's why they'll come to Isabel La Negra, sinful like the slough at the bottom of the gutter, wicked like the grounds at the end of the coffee pot. Because in Isabel La Negra's arms, everything is allowed, son. Nothing is forbidden. Our body is our only paradise, our only font of delight. And Isabel makes us understand that pleasure can make us live forever, can turn us into... God, son, though only for a short while, but a short way to die. So be quiet now, my son. Be still. Nestled here in Isabel La Negra's arms, no one will see you. No one will ever know you are merely human. Here, no one will know. No one will care that you're trembling with ague in my arms, because I'm just Isabel La Negra, the scum of the earth. And here, I swear by the holy name of Jesus that is looking on, no one will ever know that what you really wanted was to live forever, that what you really wanted was not to die. When you began getting old, Ambrosio, luck turned in my favor. You thought I was taking my duties with the boys too seriously, and that they were meeting me secretly, perhaps even paying me more than you did, so that I would finally prefer them to you. It was then you had your lawyer write up your new will, in which you left everything you owned in this world to your wife and to me. Isabella Negra stared at the sumptuously decorated walls of Isabel Luberza's living room and concluded that it was the perfect atmosphere for her new dancing hall. She could finally move out of her sleazy whorehouse, where it was so difficult to make business prosper. As she admired the gilded fauteuils, the brocaded sofas, the crystal chandeliers, she felt convinced that if the dancing hall remained in the slum, no matter how much she invested in it, it would always remain a gimcrack joint. But here, in this elegant setting, and as Isabel Luberes' partner, everything could be different. She could hire half a dozen professional models and charge at least $100 a night. She made up her mind to get rid of all the old whores with musty cunts and wrinkled breasts, and decided to invest in new down pillows and beauty rest mattresses, discarding the old Salvation Army iron cots. She was, in short, set on a first-class establishment where one could wine, dine, and dance to one's heart's delight. When the women finally finished their tour of the house, Isabel Luberza shook her visitor's hand courteously, and in doing so, took a few steps toward Isabel La Negra. She stretched out her hand and touched the procuress's face tenderly with the tip of her fingers, as though she were a soothsayer and were about to solve the riddle of life. Just when I was about to leave, she surprised me by kissing my cheeks, and then bursting out in tears. I felt a terrible pity for her, and though you must have had a heart of stone, Ambrosio, to torture her the way you did, she took my hand in hers and looked curiously at my nails, which I had just polished that day with cherries, Jubilee. She's varnished your nails the same color as mine, but it doesn't surprise me, Ambrosio. There are so many things on this earth one doesn't understand. I couldn't figure out, for instance, why you'd not only left her half your estate, but made her co-owner of this house, where you and I had been so happy. The day after the funeral, when I realized the whole town was on to what had happened, and that I was being slandered to bits, I walked through the streets hoping Isabel La Negra would die. But then, after she tore down the shack where you used to visit her, and she built the dancing hall with your money, I began to feel differently about her and finally realized what she meant to us. The first year of our marriage, when I learned Isabel was your paramour, I thought I was probably the unhappiest woman on earth. I always knew when you were coming from her house. I could tell by the heavy way your hand fell on my neck, or by the way you dragged your eyes over my body like burning sparks. It was then I had to be most careful of my satin slips and French lace underwear. It was as though the memory of her rode you when you weren't with her, and she'd sit on your back and hit you mercilessly with arms and legs, tormenting you so you'd go back to her. So I had no alternative but to stretch out on the bed and let myself be made. As you bent over me, I'd keep my eyes wide open and look out over your shoulder so as not to lose sight of her, so she wouldn't think I was giving in to her, not even by mistake. Then I decided to win you over through other ways, Ambrosio, through that ancient wisdom I had inherited from my mother, and my mother from her mother before her. I began to place your napkin in a silver ring next to your plate, to sprinkle lemon juice in your water goblet, to spread your linens on sheets of zinc under the glaring sun. I then placed the linens on your bed then when they were still warm with sunlight. I'd spread them inside out and then fold them right side up, thereby releasing, to please you when you'd finally come to bed, a subtle essence of roses. I'd place our monograms intertwined like amorous vines under your bare forearms, so they'd remind you of the sacred vows of our marriage. But all my efforts were in vain. Diamonds sown in the wind, pearls thrown on the muck heap. Thus, Ambrosio, as the years went by, Isabella Negra became for us a necessary evil, a tumor that grew in our breast, but which we nursed tenderly so that it wouldn't be bothersome. It was at dinner time that her presence was most clearly felt. A fragrance of peace would then waft up from our dinner plates, and as the icy beads slowly ran down the sides of our water goblets, it seemed as though happiness would remain forever poised on the fragile edge of our lives. I would then begin to think of her gratefully, reassembling her features in my mind in order to see her more clearly, in order to imagine her sitting next to us at the table. It was she that brought us together, Ambrosio, she that made our marital bliss possible. Since I'd never seen her, I invented her to my heart's content. I thought of her as bewitchingly beautiful, her skin dark as night when mine was milk at dawn, her hair a thick rope braided around her head when mine lay stylishly draped like a soft golden chain around my shoulders. I could almost see her strong teeth, which she rubbed daily with baking soda to whiten them, and then I thought of mine, delicate and transparent like fish scales, barely showing under my lips in a perpetually polite smile. I thought of her eyes, soft and bulging like grapes, set as a negra's eyes are wont to be in a thick, sluggish custard, and I thought of my eyes, restless and sparkling like emeralds, always coming and going through the house. Thus the years went by, Ambrosio, and thanks to Isabella Negra, I began to feel useful again. Thinking of her made me acutely aware of the importance of my duties as a housewife. I would then measure the exact amount of flour and sugar in the jars in the pantry. I would carefully count the silverware in the dining room coffer to make sure none was missing. Only then would I lie down peacefully next to you, Ambrosio, knowing that I'd done my duty and had looked after your assets. I thought I'd lost the fight until a few minutes ago, when I heard her knock on the door. I knew it was her before I opened it. She had telephoned to say she was coming, and so I'd had time to prepare myself emotionally. But when I saw her, I went weak all over. She looked exactly like I pictured her. She had lavender eyelids and thick plum-colored eyes, which made me feel like kissing them. She wore her hair undone, and it rose over her shoulders like a smoking mane. I was surprised to discover how little she'd aged, and when I thought of how much she loved you, Ambrosio, I almost felt like embracing her, like telling her, "Let's be friends, Isabel, for God's sake, let's forgive and forget." But then she began to sway her hips provocatively in front of me, balancing herself back and forth on her sparkling red rime heels, her hand on her waist and her elbow askew, so as to flaunt before my eyes the stinking hole of her armpit, the terrible shadow Suddenly I remembered everything I had suffered because of her. Beyond her stinking armpit, I glimpsed the open door of her Cadillac, a piece of her chauffeur's gilded button jacket. So I flung the door open defiantly and asked her to come in. I'd been waiting a long time for her visit. She's already successfully replaced me in all the social activities of the town in which I used to preside, holding fast to your arm like a sprig of jasmine. Now she's come to claim this house where I fought to keep your memory alive during all these years. She'll grab on to your mementos, the relics and memorabilia I've been saving for years, until she's taken them all, until she's sucked from them the last drops of your blood's dust. Because until now, these events have all been shrouded in mystery, and I haven't been able to fathom the meaning of so much suffering except through a glass darkly. But today I've begun to see clearly for the first time. Today I will confront the perfect beauty of her face to my absolute sorrow in order to understand. Now that I've drawn nearer to her, I can see her as she really is, her hair no longer a cloud of smoke raging above her head, but draped like a soft golden chain about her neck, her soft skin no longer dark but spilled over her shoulders like dawn's milk, a skin of the purest pedigree, without the merest suspicion of a kinky backlash, now swaying back and forth defiantly before her and feeling the blood flow out of me like a tide, my treacherous turncoat blood that has even now begun to stain my heels with that glorious, shocking shade I've always loved so. The shade of cherries, Jubilee. That story is called When Women Love Men by Rosario Ferre, born in Puerto Rico in 1914. Two. Okay. I think I'm doing okay for time here, so I'm going to read this other story translated from the Brazilian version of Portuguese by the great translator, in my humble opinion. But I don't know the original language, so I don't know why I said that. Anyways, but Gregory Rabassa. This writer's name is João do Rio, also known by the pseudonym, or the nom de plume, I suppose, Paulo Barreto, a Brazilian who lived only 40 years, from 1881 to 1921. Notorious as a bohemian, and dare we say, in 1881 to 1921, even though some people think this kind of behavior was just invented last week, a homosexual. Imagine that, homosexuals in the 1800s. Okay, this is called The Baby in Pink Buckram by João do Rio. A Tale of Masks. Is there anyone who hasn't been through one during his lifetime? Carnival is only interesting because it gives us that feeling of something anticipated and unforeseen. Everybody has a Carnival story, delightful or macabre, chilling or full of heavy lust. Carnival without adventure isn't Carnival. I had an adventure just this year. El Nitor de Andrade stretched lazily on the couch, enjoying our curiosity. In that study were Baron Belfort, Anatolio de Azambuja, who'd earned the ill will of so many women, and Maria de Flor, the extravagant bohemian. They were all burning to find out about Heitor's adventure. An expectant silence fell. Heitor, lighting up a genuine Giannakis, seemed absorbed. Was it a pleasant adventure? Maria asked. That depends on one's temperament. Groungy? grisly, to say the least. During the day? No, between midnight and dawn. So come on, then. Tell us about it, Anatolio begged. Look how Maria's suffering. Etor took a long drag on his cigarette. During Carnival, everybody comes out all ready to go to the limit, ready for raptures of the flesh and all kinds of wild things. Desire, close to being morbid, is kind of instilled, infiltrated into the atmosphere. Everything is giving off lust. Everything's all full of anxiety and ecstasy. And during those four paranoid days, with the jumps, the yells, the unlimited familiarity, everything's possible. Nobody's satisfied with just one woman. Or just one man, Anatolia put in. Smiles are given easily. Eyes entreat. Throats catch the tingle of nettles in the air. It's possible that a lot of people manage to be indifferent. I get that feeling. And when I go out into the low life of the city, I go along the way Phoenician sailors went during the spring procession, or Alexandrians on Aphrodite's night. Right on, Maria de Flor whispered. Of course, this year I got together with a group of four or five actresses and four or five buddies. I didn't have the courage to be all alone, like a limp rag on the swells of sensuality and pleasure all through the city. The group was my life jacket. On the first day, Saturday, we went by car to all the balls. We went along without any distinction, drinking champagne at athletic clubs that advertised balls, then on to the basest dance halls. It was rather amusing. By the time we got to the fifth club, we were all worked up. That was when I thought about a visit to the public dance on the Recreo. Good God, the first music hall star with us said, it's awful. All those common people, sailors and civvies, sluts from the depths of the Rua de São Jorge, an awful stink, fights all the time. So what? Shall we all go? That was it. We all went with the women in costume. There was nothing to be afraid of. We were able to fulfill our greatest desire, to go degenerate, to do a thorough job of debasing ourselves. We went naturally, and it was a disaster of thick-lipped, toothless black women, lounging in their stinking velveteens on the platform with the military band, all the Johns from their dismal alleys, and the strange figures of diabolical larvae, incubi in bottles of alcohol that lost women from certain streets have, young, but with their features kind of squashed in. All of them pale, pale as blotting paper or onion skin. It was nothing new, except that since the group had stopped in front of the dancers, rubbing against me, chubby and appealing, I felt the baby in pink buckram. I should say here, this is Norman speaking, that buckram is a kind of linen that is not starch, but usually stiffened with like wax or gum or something. It doesn't really, I don't think it's very popular nowadays. Anyways, the narrator continues. I looked at her legs in knee socks. Nice. I checked her arms, the slope of her shoulders, the curve of her breasts. Quite nice. As for her face, it was a bold little face with two perverse eyes and a fleshy mouth that was kind of offering itself. The only thing artificial about her was the nose, such a well-shaped nose, just right. You had to take a close look to see that it was false. I was sure of it. I stuck out my hand and pinched her. The baby sank down even lower and said with a sigh, "Oh, that hurts." You're all waiting to see how I was immediately ready to get away from the group. But there were five or six elegant ladies with me, capable of debauchery, but not ready to forgive excesses in others. And it was out of bounds for me to run off like that, abandoning them, chasing after someone from the dances at the Recreo. We went back to our cars and went off to dine at the most chic and boring club in the city. But what about the baby? The baby was left behind. But on Sunday, right there on the Avenida, riding next to the driver in that wild turmoil, I felt a pinch on my leg, and a hoarse voice said, "That's to pay you back for yesterday." I looked. It was the pink baby, smiling at me with her artificial nose, that so perfect nose. I just had time to ask her, "Where are you off to today?" "Everywhere," she answered, getting lost in a raucous group. "She was chasing you," Maria de Flor commented. "Maybe it was a man," friendly old Anatolio snorted suspiciously. "Don't interrupt, Etor," the Baron said, holding up his hand. Etor lighted another gold-tipped Giannakis, smiled and went on. I didn't see her again that night, and I didn't see her on Monday either. On Tuesday, I broke away from the group. I fell into the high seas of depravity, alone, wearing light clothing over my skin, and with all my evil instincts riding high. The whole city was like that, too. It's that time when, behind their mask, girls confess their passions to boys. It's the moment when the most secret union becomes transparent. It's when virginity becomes dubious, and all of us find it useless, chastity a bore, common sense wearisome. At that moment, everything's possible, the wildest bits of absurdity, the greatest crimes. At that moment, there's laughter that galvanizes the senses, and kisses are turned loose, naturally. I was thrilled with an almost morbid urge towards swinishness. I wanted nothing to do with showy whores, all perfumed and too well known. Nothing to do with familiar contact. But I wanted an anonymous debauchery, the ritual debauchery of arriving, grabbing, finishing, going on my way. It was ignoble. Fortunately, a lot of people suffer the same malady at Carnival. You can say that again, Maria de Flor sighed. But I was out of luck with a case of guigne, with a bad luck that's Guigne is actually French for the evil eye. With a case of guigne, with the bad luck our departed Indians used to call gaiporismo. It was a matter of getting close and the projected praise running away. I ran into San Pedro, getting involved in all the dances, rubbing up against people who weren't so clean. I repeated it, here, there, nothing doing. That's when you get the most nervous. Exactly. I was nervous all the way to the end of the dancing. I watched everybody leaving, and I went off all the more desperate. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. The movement on the streets had let up. Other dances had finished now. The squares all lighted up before with spotlights and smoking trails from Roman candles had fallen into the shadows. Shadows that were the accomplices of the pre-dawn city, and showing the revelry, the excitement of the city. Only here and there was an exhausted car carrying masked people kissing, or someone in costume swinging a ratchet along the street, fluffy with confetti. Oh, what a debilitating sight! Those unreal figures in the half shadows of the silent hours, scraping along the pavement, giving off the last sound of a ratchet here and there. It's like something you can't touch, vague, enormous, coming out of the shadows piece by piece. The hooded costumes, the crumpled ballerinas, the undecided collection of last-minute maskers dragging themselves along in exhaustion. I decided to walk through the Largo de Rossio and was passing by the Interior Ministry when I saw there standing the baby. In pink buckram. There she was. I felt my heart beating. I stopped. Good friends always find each other, I said. The baby smiled without saying a word. Are you waiting for someone? She nodded her head no. I put my arm around her. Will you come with me? Where? She asked in her hoarse voice. Wherever you want, I told her. took her hands. They were damp but well cared for. I tried to give her a kiss. She drew back. My lips only touched the tip of her nose. I was out of my mind. It wasn't necessary anymore in Carnival, especially when she said in her panting and lecherous voice, "Not here." I put my arm around her waist, and we walked along without saying a word. She was leaning against me, but she was the one leading the way, and her moist eyes seemed to be gathering in all the bestial desire that mine were speaking. There's no talking in those phrases of love. We didn't exchange a single word. She could feel the disordered rhythm of my heart and my desperate blood. What a woman! What vibrations! We'd gone back to the park. At the entrance on the Rua Leopoldina, she stopped and hesitated. Then she tugged me along, crossed the square. We went into the dark street without lights. At the end was the Fine Arts Building, desolate, mournful. I hugged her closer. She snuggled up more, the way her eyes shined. We crossed the Rua Luis de Camões and were right under the thick shadows of the Conservatory of Music. The silence was enormous. The atmosphere had a vaguely reddish tint as darkness was pushed back a bit by the glow of the distant streetlights. My pink and chubby little baby looked like something Sin had forgotten in the austerity of the night. "So shall we go?" I asked. "Where?" "To your place." "Oh, no, you can't at my place." "Well, anywhere then." "Go in, go out, get undressed. I'm not that kind." "What do you want, child? We can't stay here on the street. A policeman might come by at any moment." "Well, what's that got to do with it?" "Well, it's not impossible for them to pick us up here and make a nice end of it all as Ash Wednesday dawns. Then, when 4 o'clock comes, you've got to take off your mask."
"What mask?"
"The nose."
"Oh, yes."
And without saying another word, she pulled me toward her. I hugged her. I kissed her arms. I kissed her neck. I kissed her chin. Her mouth was offered to me greedily. All around us, the world was kind of opaque and indecisive. I sucked on her lip. But my nose felt the contact with her artificial nose, a nose that smelled of resin, a nose that made things bad. "Take off your nose," she whispered.
"No, no, it's so hard to put on."
I tried not to touch that nose, so cold over that fire-hot flesh. The piece of cardboard bulged, however, seemed to grow, and I felt a curious upset, a state of strange inhibition. "Hell, you're not going home with that. After all, it doesn't disguise anything."
"Oh, yes, it does disguise something."
"No." I looked for the cord in her hair. There wasn't any. But hugging me, kissing me, the baby in pink buckram was like a possessed woman in a hurry. Once more, her lips came close to my mouth. I gave in. The nose rubbed up against mine. The nose wasn't hers, a mask nose. Then, unable to resist, I raised my hand, brought it closer, while I hugged her tighter with the left one. And in a flash, I grabbed the piece of cardboard, tore it off. Caught by my lips, with two eyes where rage and fright seemed to be joined, I found a strange head. A head without a nose, with two bloody holes stuffed with cotton. A head that was a hallucination. A skull with flesh. I let go of her, as if vomiting myself up. I was shaking all over with horror and nausea. The baby in pink buckram fell to the ground. Her skull turned up toward me with a weeping that revealed her lips in a singular way under the hole that was her nose, her white teeth.
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Don't beat me. It's not my fault. It's only at Carnival that I can have fun. So I take advantage of it, understand? I take advantage. It was you who wanted..."
I shook her, furiously, stood her up with a wrench that must have put her bones out of joint. An urge to spit, to bring up phlegm clutched my throat. I got an urgent desire to punch that nose, break those teeth, kill that atrocious reverse side of lust. But a whistle sounded. The policeman was on the corner looking at us, taking in that scene in the half light. What was I to do? Take that skull to the police station? Tell everybody I'd kissed her? I gave up. I went off, picked up my pace, and when I got to the square, I unconsciously took off on the run for home. My jaws chattering, burning with fever. When I stopped at the door of the house to take out my key, I noticed that my right hand was clutching an oily, bloody mess. It was the nose of the baby in pink buckram. Heitor de Andrade stopped. The cigarette between his fingers was out. My Maria de Flor was showing the tightness of horror on her face. And sweet Anatolio looked ill. The narrator himself had to daub drops of sweat off his face. There was an agonizing silence. Finally, Baron Belfort stood up, rang the bell for the servant to bring some drinks, and summed it all up with, "Well, an adventure, my friends. A nice adventure. Who doesn't have his or her adventure at Carnival time? This one was thrilling at least." And he went over to sit down at the piano. That story was called The Baby in Pink Buckram by João Dorio, alias Paulo Barreto, who lived in Brazil from 1881 to 1921, who died of his excesses, but published a lot, apparently, and was a journalist, too. Both of these stories are from an excellent little volume that was gifted to me by Emilio Dayajo of... well, lately, outside Chapel Hill, Alamance County or Orange County? Right on the border there, a little tiny house community where he lives with his burning friend. Both of them studying poetry as they get ready to move to Alaska. Emilio gave me this book, The Oxford Book of Latin American Short Stories, edited by Roberto González Echevarria, and published sometime around the late 90s, close to 2000, 1997, by the Oxford University Press, and it's got all kinds of great Latin American short stories because, you know, it's a thing, I guess, to like lump people into weird little boxes. And so, you know, Latin America is like Latin America. But it's also lumped into the weird little box of history, the colonial period, the independence or new nation period, I guess, you know, like Mexican Revolution and so on. Contemporary period, where some of you might be somewhat familiar with some of the writers. I was only familiar with a few of them myself, so go figure. Anyways, that's it. I guess there's like 2 more minutes left for good night, Norman. And I guess I'm just going to say a really long good night. How I'm going to say that, I don't know. It's been a really groovy spring. I don't really know what's happening. I'm not trying to figure it out, but it seems like something is happening. The weather was nice. I like the wind for the last 4 days.